Disagree with you on the dangers of proliferation. I can't disagree with you about the horror of those weapons. But I'm afraid I have reached a different conclusion from you, even though I respect your position enormously, is that I think once this terrible technology was invented, we couldn't disinvent it. But
have now really moved to, and I would love to come back on, Tim, and have a longer conversation with you, because we've now moved to really making chemical weapons and biological weapons things that are of pariah status. We haven't done that with nuclear weapons. The UK is now breaking the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty obligations by upgrading our nuclear weapons. We can't lecture other countries not to do the same if we're doing it ourselves. So let's have a rematch when we've got a bit more time.
I'd like that. And thank you so much for joining us live from Hiroshima this afternoon. Thank you. That was Caroline Lucas, former leader of the Green Party, remembering the 80th anniversary of the dropping of a bomb on Hiroshima. That's it for me today. Thank you for your company. My producer was Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons. I'm back tomorrow from 1 o'clock. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover are next here on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Tim. 2 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. We're with you on Times Radio until 4 o'clock.
And in the next 2 hours, would you quit your job if you were told you couldn't work from home? The British Chambers of Commerce say employees at 1 in 10 businesses are voting with their feet. We'll talk to them in just a moment. Donald Trump's envoy is in Russia for meetings, including with Vladimir Putin. The Wall Street Journal's chief foreign affairs correspondent will give us his thoughts on that one. Striking doctors have agreed to talks with the government. We'll speak to a senior medic about how the relationship between both sides collapsed. And Jesus, Mary, Joseph and the wee donkey. It's only Line of Duty's Adrian Dunbar after 3:30 for our big interview.
And we'll start with the news at 2. Here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Sir Keir Starmer has said he does not recognise figures that suggest the government will need to raise taxes in the autumn budget. That's the assessment of a think tank, the NEISR, which says Rachel Rees will need to go back on some of her promises if she's to fill a £50 billion black hole. The group blames U-turns on welfare cuts and weaker-than-hoped-for growth. The Shadow Justice Secretary, Robert Jenrick, has told Times Radio the economy is in a vicious circle.
Rachel Rees and Keir Starmer have got the economy into a doom loop where higher taxes have led to lower economic growth, which is then driving what is almost certainly going to happen in the autumn, which is higher taxes still, which will further weaken the economy, drive away investors, drive away the rich that we need to be paying taxes to fuel our public services. To me, we've got to get a grip on public spending. We've got to restore confidence.
A man who murdered a grandmother on her morning dog walk while he was living off-grid to avoid being recalled to prison has been jailed for at least 25 years. 56-year-old Roy Barclay attacked Anita Rose in Brantham in Suffolk last June while she was walking her Springer Spaniel. He'd previously been jailed for an attack on another pensioner in 2015. Detective Superintendent Mike Brown.
Our thoughts remain with Anita's partner, children and grandchildren who have endured an unimaginable year and have been forced to sit through weeks of painful evidence at trial. I hope today's sentencing brings a measure of justice to them all.
US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff has met Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. It's just 2 days before the deadline President Trump has given Russia to agree to a peace deal or face more sanctions. Today is the 80th anniversary of the nuclear bomb dropped by the Allies on Hiroshima. About 55,000 people, including representatives from 120 nations, stood in Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park near the hypocenter of the blast to remember the tens of thousands who died. Stephen Walker is the author of Shockwave, Countdown to Hiroshima, in which he interviewed a huge number of witnesses. He's told Times Radio how the young men in the plane saw themselves.
Largely, this was necessary. This had to be done. This ended the war. This saved lives. There's some very strong arguments to support that. I don't think it's quite as clear-cut as that, but there are some very strong arguments to support that. Is this some kind of psychological defense mechanism when you're confronted with the kind of horrible reality of what actually happened? Perhaps 250,000 people died. We'll never know the exact figure in those two attacks. Or is it actually a mantra that they genuinely held on to because they believed it for the rest of their lives?
And a woman charged with selling Friends star Matthew Perry the drug that killed him will appear in court next month. The actor died from a ketamine overdose in October 2023 at the age of 54. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It is 4 minutes past two. You're very welcome, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio, taking you through the afternoon until 4 o'clock. And today, businesses say staff are leaving when they find out they can't work from home anymore. Be honest, does your productivity dip when you're not in your actual place of work? We'll investigate the future of space travel and the challenges that could lie ahead for some exceptionally plucky humans. Honestly, could you face life on a craft journeying to the nearest habitable exoplanet? It's called Proxima B, and it might take 250 years. So if you volunteer for this, and who would, you're actually plunging your children and their children into this potentially nightmarish scenario as well.
And their children.
And maybe their children. So lots to think about there, but...
Yes, Doctor.
Yes, indeed. back here on Earth, and Steve Witkoff is Donald Trump's envoy. He has been talking to President Putin. What, if anything, will come out of that? We'll try to find out later. Scott Bryan joins us on the week's TV news. We're going to discuss the return of MasterChef. Yes, it's back. It's on the iPlayer. It'll be on your screens, featuring Fee less banter than in previous series. Good old, yeah, that's good, isn't it? There's also a new quiz show for Gary Lineker and I Can't Bear It, You're Not Keen Either, Breaking the Fourth Wall. Why do some people on television start talking to the viewer?
I find it deeply uncomfortable.
Can't bear it.
And I really want to just say to the actors who are doing it, just get out. This is my sofa. This is my time. Stop it. Stop looking at me.
You're not my friend.
Stop it.
it happens in Annika, which I know a lot of people love that show. It's got Nicola Walker in it, and she's incredibly good normally. I love her, but I can't bear this. And also some of the competitors, contestants, what are they, in Love Island, in this series, it's the first time I've noticed it, they have talked about the fact they're being filmed. And they've mentioned the cameras, and I find that incredibly unnerving as well. So Scott will have his opinions. We'll hear from him later. And Chris Stokel-Walker brings us the latest tech news today, including why the Swedish Prime Minister now regularly asks ChatGPT for a second opinion. And some Swedish people are not too chuffed. Now, Helen has already WhatsApped to say, I think I might have expected a more convincing Irish accent from Fee when she's talking about the wee donkey. She attempted an accent because Adrian Dunbar is our guest after 3:30. What's he talking about?
Well, Helen very kindly says we know she can do it, well, which I think means, Helen, that you're a listener to the podcast where all kinds of accents are on display. But according to the terms of my contract, I'm not allowed to let them slip out here. So that's a little tease for Off Air, which drops in your podcast feed every 6 o'clock. It's a little bit bonkers and we get away with quite a lot. Adrian Dunbar is in because he's talking about the second season of Ridley, which is the show that he carries as the eponymous hero of it on ITV. Is it ITVX or is it just ITV? I never know.
Don't know.
It's on the one that's not the BBC. And he fights crime in a northern town. And Ridley himself has got an incredibly sad backstory. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to probably talk about the politics of the unification of Ireland. He's got some thoughts on NECAP. And, of course, we are going to talk about Line of Duty. Yet to be fully commissioned by the BBC, but Jed Mercurio is doing some writing and everybody is expecting that there will be something on our screens over the coming years. Maybe not a full series. And we have found out who H was, and that was the bit that carried us through 1,750 previous episodes. So we'll see what Adrian has to say about all of that. No accents, Helen, I do apologise. Maybe a little bit of blarney. Right. WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. You'll be glad that you'll be spared tomorrow afternoon, because we're not here. We're travelling to North Berwick for what should be a fantastic show at the Fringe by the Sea on Friday. So we're looking forward to that, aren't we?
Hugely looking forward to it. If you're coming to it, then we would very much like to do some decent chatting with you. This isn't going out on air. This will be going out as part of the podcast feed as well, just in case people are thinking, don't ruin my Friday.
Yeah.
Don't worry, we won't.
No, you'll have to choose to listen to it. It's not going to be inflicted upon you. Right, the most read stories on the Times website before we get to working from home. At number three, Prince Harry unhappy after watchdog criticises all sides in Centre Barlow row. The Prince resigned from the charity he founded back in March over disagreements with the chair. At number two, migrants can use human rights loophole to avoid return to France. This is about people who've crossed the channel in small boats. They may be able to avoid deportation by lodging human rights cases or claiming to be under 18. And the most read piece on the Times website right now, it is enjoyable, 75 life lessons from the likes of Giles Corran, Catelyn Moran and Matthew Paris. This is a piece from the Weekend magazine. It is already available online. Some suggestions. Lynn Barber has written that all insurance is a waste of money. Giles Corran argues that you don't understand a book properly until you read it twice. And he also recommends that every household should have a cat. Can't disagree with him there. But Matthew Paris is causing the biggest kerfuffle, certainly on our desk in the office. He has suggested that shampoo is unnecessary. And if you've got a spare couple of minutes this afternoon, I do suggest that you go to thetimes.com and look at some of the comments underneath that article. Not everyone agrees with Matthew Paris on the anti-shampoo front.
No, it's very controversial.
Oh, it's turned out to be very, very controversial indeed. Now, sorry, you can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription. If you don't have one, treat yourself. Go and get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
I think we'll drip feed some of this advice throughout the programme this afternoon. Farah Storr, who's former Elle editor and the author of a Substack newsletter called Things Worth Knowing, is intriguing. I like nearly every single one of her suggestions. So you'll never regret buying a red swimsuit. Never have hot tea on a plane. It will always taste 80% worse than normal. It's true, isn't it?
Yeah, it's horrible.
It's water. The water is hot. It's a tea bag. It's normal milk, but it tastes absolutely disgusting. Always go to the toilet if you have the chance. Definitely, definitely, definitely. Nothing cleans as well as Imperial leather soap. That's so true. And nobody remembers how you walked into a situation, but they do remember how you left. It's stunning stuff. And
yeah, I'm sorry, but I am quite shampoo positive. And I don't think that's an unreasonable stance. Can I just read some of what Matthew Paris has said?
If you must.
Only in middle age did I learn, he says, that you shouldn't use shampoo. We were in the wilds for a fortnight without it. I just used water. At first, as expected, my hair got greasy, but then it started getting less greasy all on its own. And my brother Roger explained that tiny sebaceous glands in the scalp secrete natural oil to moisturise, to repel water, to protect from suddenness in the rain and to defend the scalp from UV rays and dry skin, i.e. dandruff. Yeah, that's why I suggest you go to thetimes.com, look at some of the comments. One woman in particular says that she's come across some really smelly heads and she's extremely shampoo positive as a result. Just putting it out there.
0333 003 2353. Any thoughts are very welcome. Kind of. Almost one in 10 businesses are seeing staff quit after they were told to stop working from home. That's from a survey published in the paper today, which also found nearly half of businesses wanting staff back in the office full time. 41% thought remote working made their employees less productive. Well, Jane Grattan is the Deputy Director of Public Policy for the British Chambers of Commerce, which carried out the survey. And we're also joined by Sir Kerry Cooper, Professor of Organisational Psychology and Health at Manchester University's Business School. Jane, can I start with you? Does your survey tell you what kind of person is quitting after being told to stop working from home?
No, but it does look at how many businesses are thinking this way. So we're definitely seeing a trend to more on-site working. It's not uniform and it will vary across sectors. So it doesn't suit everyone. It doesn't suit all individuals. It doesn't suit all businesses. But some employers are saying a full site, a full on-site model works best, you know, for their operational needs. And so, like you say, 41% are saying they're asking staff to do more time in the office than they were 12 months ago. And nearly half are expecting all working days to be on site in the next 12 months.
For a while, Jane, I thought we were being told that actually an awful lot of businesses were finding that their employees were more productive when they were working from home. What changed?
Well, I think since the pandemic, businesses have had a chance to assess all of this. So we know hybrid working's become a fixture really of modern working life. It really helps firms attract and retain skilled workforce because people can balance home and work responsibilities. But some businesses are saying, particularly as their employment costs are rising, so we've seen a massive hike in national insurance, we've seen a massive hike in wage inflation, other business costs are rising, for, you know, particularly for firms trading internationally with tariffs and materials and shipping costs. The costs on businesses are huge and firms are looking at every way they can to boost productivity. And for some firms, they're saying bringing people back into the office really helps. It helps with communication of ideas and information. The workforce feels more cohesive. There's more opportunities for people to learn and gain experience, and managers are perhaps better able to support people in their roles. So we're seeing this, and we think we will continue to see this to evolve in the next 12 months.
But what happens to those businesses who are seeing staff quit if those staff are really essential to the businesses?
Well, I think it will add to the skills crisis. So we know one of the reasons for wage inflation is that firms are struggling to attract the skilled people that they need. So it is a balance and it is a choice. And I think that's something that businesses would you know, take the decision fully aware of, really. So, you know, it's a choice for people where they want to work and how they want to work, but also a choice for businesses if they have to make that requirement because it makes good business sense for them.
Yeah.
They need the flexibility to do that.
But I suppose the question that I asked you at the beginning, Jane, just about what type of person is quitting, if it turned out that these were parents who had managed to arrange their family life and their working life to suit both those demands, and we're doing it quite successfully, then actually we're going a step back in the working world, aren't we?
I think it's your definition of flexible working. I mean, lots of people think that flexible working means working from home, and it doesn't. It's just a small part of that. So firms have been as flexible as they can. You know, they are offering, for example, part-time working, job share, annualised hours, term time working, you know, adjusting the start and finish of shifts so that people can maybe drop, you know, your children off at school and pick them up and balance demands. So flexible working is more than just hybrid or remote working. And some people, you know, will need to be able to work from home. And again, I think at that point, people looking for jobs will need to consider that when they look at the jobs market, what the requirement of that employer is going to be.
Jane, thank you very much. Let's turn to Kerry Cooper, Professor of Organisational Psychology at Manchester University. Are you surprised, do you think, that this is quite a high figure, a low figure, 1 in 10 workers quitting?
No, I think it's a low figure. I think more will be quitting. I think the issue here, and Jane hit it actually, what we really want, let's look at the evidence rather than what people think, because senior management tends to be made up of older workers, people in their 50s and 60s who are used to full-time working in an office. I did a book where I looked at I asked the scientists. The book is called Flexible Work. It was published in 2020. So the evidence was pre the pandemic. And I had people in Australasia, academics in Australasia, North America, Europe, and Southeast Asia. We looked at the evidence. The evidence was when people work flexibly, it hit the bottom line. People tended to stay longer with their employer. They were much more productive where you could measure it. The difficulty there is productivity depends on the kind of job you do. And also that they were much more job satisfied and they had better work-life balance. So the evidence was clear. I then did a book 2 years later called Remote Workplace Culture, where I looked at, well, okay, now we've had the pandemic and now people are working hybridly, right? What's the evidence there? Again, if you could work flexibly, and by the way, flexible means I want to work 5 days a week. No, I want to work 2 days a week. But they negotiate that with their line manager. So you have a line manager, and ideally the way the workplace should operate and which and the way in which HR should operate is they should – every manager should negotiate with every individual about what suits them and what suits the company.
Right.
And they come up with a psychological contract. And that contract says, I'm coming in on these occasions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, when there's a meeting, a strategy meeting, and so on and so forth. So flexible working – I'm talking about the science shows that it will help productivity, and the more employers force people back into the workplace 5 days a week, we have problems with productivity anyway in the UK. You know, we're bottom of the productivity league in the G7, tied with Italy. We're not doing very well. I haven't been doing very well for decades. For us to regress back to the old model of come into the workplace full time, some employees will want to come in, tend to be older. And the question you said to Jane, Fee, is right. The issue is it's the Z generation and the young millennials and those about 35 to 45-year-olds who have families. Those are the people who will leave a workplace that requires them to come back full time. That's not the way we have new technology. You know, this is ridiculous. We should use it to our advantage.
Right. But I mean, it's a very febrile time for companies. And it's so difficult having this conversation as well, isn't it, Professor? Because a small company has different requirements, expectations, and jeopardy to very large companies. So, you know, let's just put that out there first of all. But
That's a very good point, Fee. But can I make a point about that?
Sure.
I did something for the CBI a number of years ago now, a quality of working life survey. And you know who's the most flexible? The small employer. The SMEs, the reason people stay with SMEs and like working for a small and medium-sized business is because they have always been flexible. They know Fred. They have 50 employees. They know Fred. They know Janet. And they know what their personal circumstance is. And if they need to work flexibly, they do. They've always been good. It's the larger companies and the large medium companies that have always demanded, you know, we'd like you in the workplace 5 days a week, except when the pandemic hit. And then life began to change. Yeah. But you are right.
Is it, yeah. Is it realistic, Professor, to ever expect a large company to be able to offer kind of individual flexibility to its employees? Isn't
they
that
do.
Just well? But doesn't that
Some
create a
do.
Huge headache for them?
Yeah, to be honest with you, that's not the case. I mean, I'm chair of something called the National Forum for Health and Wellbeing at Work, and we have 55 global employers in it. Okay, we're talking HR directors, chief medical officers, and directors of health and wellbeing for these companies. We've been going for 6 years, right? The vast majority of my members of the National Forum do this flexible working. That's what they do. So we already have it in a number of the bigger companies, not all. And by the way, some people do have to be at the coalface. There are people, there are nurses, there are bus drivers, there are pilots. I mean, they can't work flexibly. They can't work partly from home. The nature of their job requires it. But, you know, we're in a new world now, and we need the evidence base. We don't need dinosaurs, i.e. very senior managers whose life appeared 5 days a week or probably 6 days a week, as it were, working partly at the weekend, to tell the younger generation who now have the technology and have the want to work more flexibly. That doesn't mean they don't want to work hard and deliver the a product, but working people in a central office where there's so much downtime of traveling in and out of London, in and out of Manchester, Glasgow, it's just a waste of
It makes no sense to them, does it? Well, I look forward to when they're in charge for many, many reasons. And thank you very much indeed for your time, Kerry Cooper, Professor Organisational Psychology at Manchester University. That takes us to 22 minutes past two. Would love your thoughts on that.
Next on Times Radio, how would you design a spaceship that could travel to outer space? And I do mean outer space, potentially for hundreds of years. What would it look like? How would it be powered? Could you have a go? You can let us know what you think. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Donald Trump's special envoy Steve Witkoff is Moscow-bound before the US deadline for Russia to end the war in Ukraine expires. At play, costly penalties for Russia and any country that trades heavily with them. We'll cover that for you. Adam Bolton applies his big brain to our daily look at UK politics, and with us to discuss the big stories of the day, the Labour peer Diane Hayter and the Conservative commentator LB Amancona.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
When you're growing a small business, you need someone who understands the ins and outs. And whether you're a tailor or an accountant, you need the tools to succeed. With an HSBC Small Business Banking account, you'll have free accounting tools and access to our business specialists, virtually or in person. Because whatever your small business looks like, we're with you all the way. Search HSBC Small Business Banking account to get started. Subject to application, eligibility, credit check and T's and C's. Visit hsbc.co.uk for details.
Wow, Direct Line sorted my claim with a 5-year guarantee on the car repairs. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like getting my kids to eat their greens.
Mummy, the vegetable van is here. Please can I have a broccoli pop? Or a courgetto? Please?
Go on then.
Direct Line, that's how it's done.
Valid whilst the car is yours. Must use approved repairers. Excludes poor maintenance, later damage, wear and tear.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, as you know, broadcasting is very strictly regulated, and whenever we do an item about space, we have to play this music. So here we go.
I was hoping for Sam Ryder's Spaceman.
No, no, because that's not the law of broadcasting.
Move with the times, kids.
OK, let's bring in the Initiative for Interstellar Studies, which has recently held a competition inviting teams of scientists, engineers, architects and social theorists to develop detailed plans of how humans, that's us, could feasibly travel deep into outer space using current technology. The initiative has found a winner, and we can talk to the executive of the initiative, Dr. Andreas Hein. Dr. Hein, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me.
Great pleasure. Can you tell us a little bit about your initiative? What exactly do you do?
So the Initiative for Interstellar Studies is a UK-based not-for-profit company, and we are doing research and education towards interstellar travel. So we organize, for example, competitions like Project Hyperion, where we actually try to move that field forward by generating new knowledge and getting deeper insights into how we could potentially get to the stars.
Okay, so we need to make clear that the people involved in these plans for future space travel are highly, highly qualified, experienced people with a fantastic range of specialisms. How did you find the winner? And tell us a little bit about why this particular idea won.
So the winners were selected by an international jury, and within those within the jury, we had experts from architecture, engineering, and the social sciences. And we had a process where they graded all the designs. We did a ranking, and then we had a couple of discussions where we determined ultimately the winner. It was very tough because a lot of those designs were excellent. And this particular design, Chrysalis, it stood out because of its enormous level of detail, and the concept itself was quite innovative in terms of its architecture, but also how it brings together engineering, but the overall design of the ship, the habitat, and how people would actually live on the ship.
What did it look like? How big would it be?
So this particular ship is like a humongous ship. I mean, it's the size of... I don't know exactly about UK geography, but it's like 58 kilometers. Just think about the distance between your closest town and maybe the next one. So it's like a huge ship. The habitat itself is, if I recall correctly, a couple of kilometers long. So we're really talking about like a, how to say, even like small country-sized ship.
Okay, so we don't yet have the technology to propel a vessel of this enormous size through space, do we? It doesn't exist.
Yeah, the propulsion system we would need would still have to be developed. So we have candidates such as fusion propulsion, laser cell propulsion. And these propulsion systems are currently under development. We are not yet there, but we think that it's not that unlikely that within the next 10 to 20 years, we would at least have a prototype of that propulsion system.
Now, probably in my ignorance, I mentioned Proxima B, which I understood to be our nearest potentially habitable planet. And I quoted a figure of 250 years to get there, but we've already been challenged on that by at least one listener who says it would take thousands of years to get there. What is the truth?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on how fast you may get with the ship. I mean, 250 years was just like a ballpark figure where we would need to have the speed of maybe half of a percent of the speed of light. But yeah, ultimately it depends on how much fuel you have and how do you say the quality of the propulsion system. So it's a little bit hard to say because it also depends on the size of the ship. So the bigger the ship, the more propellant you would need. So yeah, it's not a straightforward. It's difficult to give a straightforward answer to that.
And the vessel would need obviously to have the capacity to grow food.
Yes, that's a requirement because you can't carry all of the food with you. So you essentially have to have what we call like a bioregenerative life support system. So imagine you're sitting like in a greenhouse and everything is like self-contained inside that greenhouse. That's the equivalent of a bioregenerative life support system.
It's just absolutely fascinating. I really wish we had more time, but thank you very much for talking to us about it. That is Dr. Andreas Hein of that incredible place, the Initiative for Interstellar Studies. But just imagine that. Hundreds of years travelling around space in a huge greenhouse.
I don't want to. I mean, for all of the curiosity in the world, physically, I wouldn't want to, Jane.
And what about shampoo?
I can see that we're going to become obsessed by this afternoon.
Would you take a huge vat of shampoo with you?
I don't think so. Thank you to everybody who is contributing about working from home. Many stories to come. We will get to those as soon as we can in the next half an hour of the programme. We will also talk about the doctors' strikes being over for now, but how do we stop them coming back? It is 2:31, and let's get the latest news with Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister is playing down a report suggesting major tax rises will be needed in the next budget. He says he doesn't recognise some of the figures from a think tank, the NIESR. It says Rachel Rees will need to find £41 billion to cover the costs of weak economic forecasts and tax reversals. But the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, says there are some positive economic signs as well.
We will build on what we've done in the first year of this government. We've stabilised the economy. That means interest rates have been cut now four times. And for anybody watching this on a mortgage, that makes a huge difference on a monthly basis to how much they pay. In the first year, we've raised wages as well, both in the private sector plus the minimum wage, which means people have got a bit more money coming into their pocket.
Talks between the US and Russia held this morning were useful and constructive, according to Kremlin aide Yuri Ushakov. US envoy Steve Witkoff and Vladimir Putin met in Moscow. Their discussion is said to have lasted almost 3 hours. The United Nations has expressed deep alarm at reports Israel could be about to expand its military operations in Gaza. Benjamin Netanyahu reportedly wants to occupy the whole of the Strip. The UN says it could have catastrophic consequences for millions of Palestinians and also endanger the lives of the remaining Israeli hostages. And Saudi Pro League side Al Hilal are understood to have agreed a deal with Liverpool for striker Darwin Nunez. The Uruguay international had been expected to feature for the Reds in the Community Shield final against FA Cup winners Crystal Palace on Sunday. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
At Kia, we're excited to announce that the refined new Kia Sportage is available in showrooms now. Secure your test drive today to explore its advanced technology and stylish, sporty design. Order before the 30th of September to get 5.9% APR representative and £1,000 PCP finance deposit contribution. Search the new Kia Sportage to book your test drive. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
At Viking, we believe travel should be more than just a trip. It should be a doorway to cultural insight and personal enrichment. Start planning your river, ocean, or expedition journey today and discover why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Learn more at viking.com.
Wake up to a brighter breakfast. Times Radio Breakfast, 7 days a week from 6 a.m. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Right, Callum McDonald will tell us what's in his programme in a couple of moments' time, but so many of you want to talk about flexible working. This one comes in from John in Sheffield, who says civil servants are being mandated to work at least 60% of time in the office from September, sold on the basis of teamwork, innovation, learning, etc. But you choose which days you go in, so likely you'll not be in on the same days. And for example, in my case, even if nobody in your team is based in your office, do I have to comply? Well, yes, there is no choice. So I now go in and have Teams calls from the office instead of home because nobody else on my team is located there. It takes me 3 hours a day and costs 150 quid a month. It's driving me crazy. What sense your professor guest made? Very refreshing. I'm looking for another job. I want to bring in this one from Mike Fletcher as well, who's got a direct comparison because his eldest daughter has worked from home since she finished university. She works for a computer games company, as does her partner. Now, the daughter works from home daily. The partner goes into the office most days. His company feels they all need to get round the table. His daughter's company doesn't. And although both companies are doing well, Mike adds, my eldest daughter has been nominated for 3 BAFTAs in gaming. Her partner, who goes into the office every day, hasn't.
Oh, well,
so
there we
what
are.
Does that tell you? But also, congratulations. 3 BAFTAs in gaming, only 8 years out of university.
Fantastic.
Is a phenomenal achievement. So, it is all down to personal experience. And a final one for now, but do keep them coming and we'll make room for them later. It's from Andrew, who just makes the really, really good point that the professor did try to make. I'm a delivery driver, also servicing drinking water machines in workplaces, 40 hours a week on contract, tracker in van, speed monitored. Can the professor in academia advise on how I arrange a flexible psychological contract with my employer? Well, Andrew, I think he did go on to say that there is a base of people in this country who are never going to be entitled to the kind of flexibility that an awful lot of other people discuss. So our apologies if that got your goat today. Callum, hello.
Hello. How are you doing?
Yes, we're doing very well.
Good.
How's your week going?
It's going well. It's going very quickly. It's very it's strange when you see, you know, all the daylight hours. It's lovely, though. It's very nice. Nice to see you guys. I was listening to your podcast at the weekend, actually, on the drive.
Oh, dear.
It was
sorry.
It was wonderful.
Oh, no.
You're good company, you know.
Oh, no, we appreciate it. Who did we have in the other day who was on a very long journey and was listening to audiobooks?
Oh, gosh.
We both just sat here silently
weeping.
Do this flipping thing.
We look like
four days
we can
a week.
Take it, but we can't.
No.
So thank you for that.
Well, you're welcome. That's what I'm here for. Right, coming up on Drive after 4 o'clock. This is one of those afternoons in the newsroom where we're kind of waiting to see what emerges from conversations between President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, and the Russians. He's been meeting Vladimir Putin and others in Moscow today. So far, we've heard that the talks were constructive. We would expect more information than that at some point over the next couple of hours, so we're waiting to see what emerges there. Something else we're going to look at today is some analysis of exam results in Scotland, which suggests that students are choosing PE over modern languages, which I think is probably quite predictable and understandable. If we're all being encouraged to be healthier, shouldn't young people do PE instead of learning how to ask for directions to the train station in French?
Yes, où est la douane? But also, don't you think that the younger generation knows it can rely on Google Translate, and they have probably, if they've been abroad, already found it's incredibly easy to just type into your phone or speak into your phone what you want to say and have it translated. And AI is going to make exactly that kind of facility available to everybody.
That's so true. And actually, there's technology now where you can wear sort of wearable headphone-type things that will translate simultaneously as you're listening to someone. I don't think it's perfect, so I don't think it's particularly mainstream, but that exactly that sort of thing does exist. So we'll be considering that, and if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I did Gaelic and German when I was in secondary school.
Gaelic and German?
Yeah.
Wow.
What a combo.
Well, give us a bit of Gaelic, go on.
Madingva. That's good morning.
Oh, right.
I realise it's the afternoon. I can't remember what the afternoon is.
What
it's my
grades,
dad's first language.
What grades
famously.
Did you get?
I got... well, they were standard grades, so I got ones, which was the best you could do.
Yeah,
for both.
This is no place for modesty.
For both of them. We will move on. The other thing we want to talk about today is President Trump going on a destructive streak, believe it or not, this time of some satellites. Now, these satellites monitor greenhouse gas emissions. They're used by scientists, by oil and gas companies, by farmers as well, to keep an eye on CO2 levels and carbon dioxide levels, and to monitor crop health. But Donald Trump wants them to be taken out of action. I guess if the data's not there, the problem goes away.
Yeah, that's
so true.
Yeah, so true, absolutely. He's onto something, isn't he? Thank you very much, Callum. Callum, your brilliant guide to the late afternoon and evening here on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and 7. Now, Eric has given some thought to this concept of the 250-year-long space trip. And I think this is a good question. What happens if the third generation of humans on this space flight are thick as mince and just aren't up to much? Do they just arrive and go, ooh? And it's a good point. I mean, these incredibly gifted people, if this ever happens, will be sent out into the outer reaches of space on our behalf. But we don't know what their children and grandchildren are going to be like.
But also, Jane, I don't think we yet know whether you can give birth in space.
Well, we've got a medical guest coming up, so we could put that point to her. It's actually Dame Claire Gerard, a former president of the Royal College of GPs. This is because talks between the British Medical Association and the government are set to restart in an attempt to avoid more strikes. BMA leaders met the health secretary yesterday and agreed to pause industrial action while they negotiate. But with the government so far refusing to move at all on pay, we're asking how we got here and what kind of compromise might actually last. Dame Claire Gerard, good afternoon to you. Do you take comfort in the fact that at least for the moment the strikes are off?
Yeah, and good afternoon, Jane. Lovely to see you again. And we need a bucket load of midwives if you've got a 250-year journey anyway. Yeah, I'm really pleased. Of course, we're all pleased. And I think I need to congratulate everyone for being able to, what I hear is to postpone or to stall the strikes. But you ask, you know, what can we do now? And I have been looking after doctors. I've looked after doctors the best part of 20 years, doctors with mental illness. And what I've been hearing over the last nearly two decades is it's not so much about the pay, but it's the conditions that doctors work in. And many of them are demoralised, dejected, depressed. And they talk about the inability to practice their craft in the way that they were taught to do, to practice with the time that they need for patient care, to even have a doctor-patient relationship that isn't interfered with by bureaucracy or the ticking clock or all the tasks that are not medically, not, you know, but directly involving the patient. So I think what the government needs to do is to start looking at why doctors are so demoralised despite doing what is in essence one of the best jobs in the world.
And what about money? Because I know that, and I know it's not all about money, and you've made that very clear already. Wes Streeting has already said, look, he's not going to negotiate on the money because resident doctors have had these pay rises, nearly 30% in the last 3 years. And you listen to that and you think, well, actually, that's brilliant by everybody else's standards. It isn't just about the money, but can the money be improved? Should it be improved?
I'm not close enough to the details on that, Jane, to be able to give an intelligent answer. I do know that doctors, when they talk about their first year of their residence, so straight out of medical school, are paid the same as they talk about being, say, paid the same per hour as a plumber or whatever. But we know that doctors' salaries rise fairly rapidly as you go up through your training. And they reach, you know, we're some of the best paid public servants in the country. So I think it's important that the doctors, of course, talk about money. But as I said, I'm not close enough to the detail on that.
So what about the level of interaction between patients and doctors, which you've referenced? Does it actually just come down to them having more time with a patient?
It's a lot of issues, Jane. It's more than just more time. The space between the doctor and the patient, and I'm a GP, and I've seen this throughout my professional career, is now cluttered. It's cluttered with the blinking computer telling me I've got to measure data, to do things that aren't patient-directed or even doctor-directed, to measure things that the patient doesn't even maybe want to be measured. It's cluttered with surveillance, with constant bureaucracy about having to prove that I'm a good enough doctor. So it's a lot of things. For doctors in training, they have very little autonomy about their working day. They don't even, and we've talked about this before, they, you know, if they're getting married, say, in 12 months' time, they can't guarantee that they're going to have that day off unless they are between jobs. So they can't guarantee that they can take annual leave. Now you can say, well, why should they? Well, actually, most jobs, you could start to plan a holiday date 12 months in advance. So, and in some places, doctors haven't even got a peg to hang their coat on or hot meals at night. So there's a lot that has been examined over the years, but very little change has happened. And this is new. This is something that has come in. It's crept in over the last 20 years. When I was training, you know, I got hospital accommodation. I got hot meals at night. I was looked after by my firm. I felt part of a team. We know that doctors today, many, many doctors, feel like isolated actors. They might be connected in systems, but they feel isolated and lonely working shifts that don't really work for them, if they might work for the hospital, but they don't work for what doctors need, which is to work in teams, to bounce ideas off. So I think Wes Streeting now starts to have to really look at the systems that are going wrong, that are making these really wonderful people who go in with the best intentions remove their labour, which is, if you think about it, one of the most profound things a doctor can do. When you think that we have to make the patient our first concern, is the first line of the Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah, but of course, we shouldn't forget that actually less than a third of resident doctors joined the most recent strike.
Yeah, and actually, word on the street, I've talked to a lot of doctors. I think a lot of doctors joined the 2016 strike, but a lot of doctors now, for one reason or other, feel that they can't buy into this. But it doesn't take away the fact, and it's not just doctors that make these sacrifices, by the way. If we make it right for doctors, we will make it right for nurses and all the other professional groups. But I think it is important that we start, or those in authority, start to look at the systems that we're working in. It's nobody's fault. You heard about, you just had a piece about AI. But yeah, it's changes that are going on in medicine now that we need to address, rather than say, well, they're not going to happen. AI isn't going to change the way doctors work. Of course it's going to change the way doctors work. It already is. So we need to start understanding it and understanding the losses that many might feel around all these changes that are happening.
So would the young Claire become a doctor now in 2025?
Oh, gosh, without a doubt. The thing is, for me, I knew I wanted to be a doctor from about the age of six. My father was a single-handed GP. I used to go on his home visits with him. It has been the most extraordinary profession. But the older Claire now feels that unless we start to really change how doctors work, actually, it isn't as exciting a job as I've had for the last 40 years. We have to go back to that the art of caring, that is the essence of being a doctor, is the doctor-patient relationship. It has to start there, and we have to start decluttering everything that stops doctors of tomorrow being able to have a sort of profession which I've had over the last 40 years.
Can I just put a point to you from a listener who says, can you remind Claire that it was the rollover and surrender attitude of her generation of so-called junior doctors, now resident doctors, who let the government cut doctors' pay every year for 20 years and led to this crisis in the first place?
I don't really understand that, because I've never been in a position where I've had the authority to alter the pay. I started, by the way, Jane, in 1978, which was the first junior doctor strike, if I remember. It's probably slightly after that. If anybody's listening to this, please forgive me for exact dates. So I have seen, I've also been on marches throughout my career. I remember going on marches to stop medical school closes. I was on march when the junior doctor's hours went from 120, and we fought very hard to reduce junior doctor's hours from 120 to 80 hours. And I was on marches and collected money to help and lobby. I was also one of the first people, the first leaders in the profession, to challenge the 2012 NHS Act, which was going to affect the doctor-patient relationship. So I think the individual who sent that needs to go and look back at history.
Okay, so no need to have a go at you individually. Just very briefly, and thank you for everything you've said so far. It's really interesting. Fee's question about giving birth in space, and I don't mean this in a kind of throwaway way. Do we have any idea at all whether it would be possible?
Yeah, it would, because you can give birth in water. I've been thinking about this, but I don't think it's about the giving birth that matters. I mean, you've got to push, but as I said, you can give birth in water. You can also give birth if you're paralysed. I mean, let's be honest. So you don't necessarily, it'd be very hard, but it's more to the point, how many midwives are you going to have on that trip, and how do you give birth to the midwives? Are they going to be trained in midwifery? Are they going to be remote systems that and digital systems that help you do that? Because we talked about remote working, you can't be a remote midwife. So
but also, Claire,
my evening, because I'm going to have to go away and start thinking about this.
Wouldn't it be extremely difficult for a baby to develop as normal if there were zero gravity challenges? I mean, muscle wastage and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, is it feasible?
I imagine the clever people building these will build special pods where they increase the pressure so that actually you add gravity or some sort of proxy gravity within the system. If you've got the technology to travel for 250 years, I think they would have thought about that. But I don't think they have quite grappled how you are going to deliver the skills that are needed to carry what would be about five or six or seven generations that have to go through in those 250 years. And that was the minimum he cited. Yeah. I mean, he said it was tens of thousands of years. Anyway, I'll long since be dead by then, so I won't have to worry about that.
No, don't lose any sleep on this one on our behalf, but it's fascinating. It does suggest work still to be done there. Dr. Claire Gerada, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. It is Times Radio, 3:09.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6 with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
At Kia, we're excited to announce that the refined new Kia Sportage is available in showrooms now. Secure your test drive today to explore its advanced technology and stylish, sporty design. Order before the 30th of September to get 5.9% APR representative and £1,000 PCP finance deposit contribution. Search the new Kia Sportage to book your test drive. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
How are you looking so fresh?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8. It's got this thing called Running Coach, which creates custom training plans just for me. Oh, and that's our cue to pick up the pace.
What? This isn't fast enough. Oh.
Smash your fitness goals with a new Galaxy Watch 8. Buy today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It is exactly 8 minutes to the hour. Scott Bryant joins us every week at this time to talk television. Should we just get the MasterChef, the slot that is always, let's talk about MasterChef, out of the way to start with, Scott? What's happening now?
So we've had the first episode air, or the first three episodes actually air on iPlayer. Which has been anticipated. These episodes have dropped. I've seen at least the first one. I mean, there's been some reporting, including in the Times, about what will be different in regards to the fact that both John Turode and Glenn and Greg Wallace even are no longer a part of the programme. And I think what is a surprise is they are actually in it, I think, as much as they have been before in prior series. It's just the fact that what they are doing on this show is fundamentally different. Normally, they would be there to provide a bit of light relief, you know, have a bit of a, particularly Greg, have a bit of banter with a contestant. That's been pretty much stripped out, so that all of the conversations are pretty much along the lines of, what are you cooking? I've got some scepticism about that ingredients. And then, of course, their reactions as they tried the food, as well as introducing the challenges. They're sort of, even though MasterChef has sort of taken itself always very seriously, I think the humour that used to be a little bit there in drips and drabs, it's pretty much gone now. But still a surprise, I think, that they're showing up as much, considering that this is a show with two hosts that are no longer, going forward, going to be the hosts of that programme.
Do you think there'll be any impact on the ratings at all?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because I have spoken to some people both within the TV industry and outside the TV industry who have said, I'm not having anything to do with this series. I think it's inappropriate for it to be airing in light of the fact that these allegations were upheld. But also, I mean, there's no denying the fact that this has been a story that's dominated for news now, particularly the tabloid papers, for weeks.
Yeah.
So I would imagine, as have I, I'm not a regular MasterChef viewer. I have seen it, of course, a part of my work, but, you know, I tuned in specifically this morning to see what has been different. So I imagine quite a lot of people will be doing the same.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Whether or not they then stick with the whole series, I think, is the measure of the success of the decision made by the BBC. And also, Scott, if the brand is tarnished, I honestly don't know, and I've loved the brand in the past, I don't know whether I care enough about somebody cooking lamb three ways in order to go through yet another iteration of presenters. I think it's just, you know, it's done. The oven's broken, it's done.
I mean, I think this is the thing. This is a show which manages to, I think, be very similar. I've always felt this. A lot of MasterChef is exactly the same. Sometimes you can just repeat the same episode. I'm not sure whether people will even notice. But it's also the fact that this is just about, I would say, the BBC's most popular cooking format. It's on at least 40 episodes a year, 24 episodes in this series, plus the celebrity series that they've not made a mind up about yet, because that's got to road in, plus two Christmas specials, of course. And I always wonder, you know, what happens to the Christmas episodes they didn't show from last year. Is there a vault they stay in? I mean, it's interesting to see what happens to shows when they don't air, as much, I find personally, as a TV geek, as much as the shows that they end up doing.
Can we talk about breaking the fourth wall, which is something that intrigues me and irritates me actually profoundly? Annika, that show that otherwise I'd buy into because I really love Nicola Walker, is ruined for me by the fourth wall. And then some of the participants in Love Island this season have referenced the cameras and talked about how they'll spend the prize money. Isn't that odd as well?
It is a little bit odd. I mean, I have seen Annika. I like Annika. I would say a challenge that crime shows have is that they can end up being so many of them. It's our nation's greatest export, crime dramas. I should say, it's important to say the last word, isn't
yes.
it? That you can end up having them being quite derivative and not really, really standing out. So that's why you've seen them try so many different things. Now, that's why you've got Cameron Peary on at the moment. It's on ITV. It's great. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of nostalgic feel, a lot of humour in that based on the books by Val McDermid. It's why with Annika, we started on a sort of crime channel, You and Alibi, why she does break the fourth wall. For me, it's just that jarring, because I always think of the fact that there are cameras behind picking up what she's speaking to. Like,
yeah.
I can't get beyond the realm of TV. It makes a nice change from, you know, having maybe flashbacks, flash forwards to situations that you're not necessarily given the full info of. That's my major frustration with these sort of dramas. Or, you know, it's the fact that sometimes you have women who are just basically given this sort of as a brutal victim with no autonomy. I think that's one of the greatest issues I face facing for genre. But yeah, I agree. It can be a little bit weird.
Yeah. Can we just talk briefly about Channel 4's documentary on Bonnie Blue? This is the woman who has slept with an astonishing amount of men, feels empowered by it. She says so many people have been really upset by this, Scott, because actually it has put a type of image available to under 18s on Channel 4, hasn't it? The only thing that you're asked is, are you over 18? And it's up to you whether or not you click and you're honest about your age.
I mean, I would say that, I mean, in the Times earlier, there was a report about how some advertisers have stepped away from being associated with that programme because of the content within it. I think it's also just interesting just to see the reaction of this. I mean, Bonnie Blue's been an online OnlyFans creator and has built up a considerable amount of controversy, but also just, you know, many people are very familiar with what she does. And of course, this documentary, I guess, has put her kind of beliefs and opinions and approach under scrutiny. But I guess, I mean, I haven't seen the whole thing. I've only sort of been watching the first half of it in the last hour or so. I guess there are questions in regards to whether there was enough scrutiny. But I think it's also a wider question that in regards to Bonnie Blue, that part of her, I think, drive, in my opinion, is her publicity at all costs method. And of course, having a documentary that does call it her methods into question will obviously give her what she wants, which is more publicity. So it just merely fuels it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it does make sense. I can understand why she'd want to participate in it. But I do personally think that Channel 4 has made a mistake in putting it in the same kind of slot as other documentaries that don't have what is usually uncensored or censored content in it. Scott, thank you.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
3 o'clock now. Thank you, Scott. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio until four. Now, in the next hour, Steve Witkoff has had a meeting with President Putin. What might that mean? We'll talk about that. We also have a big guest in the form of Adrian Dunbar. Looking forward to that. And Chris Stokel-Walker looks at the tech news and the Swedish Prime Minister. He likes a second opinion, and these days he's getting it from ChatGPT. Would you be all right with that? Here's the news at three, Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Some breaking news. And Birmingham Airport's runway is temporarily closed. It's because of what it calls an aircraft incident. It's apologised for the inconvenience caused to passengers. Sir Keir Starmer has said he does not recognise figures that suggest the government will need to raise taxes in the autumn budget. That's the assessment of a think tank, the NIESR, which says Rachel Rees will need to reverse some of her promises if she's to fill a £50 billion black hole. It blames U-turns on welfare cuts and weaker-than-hoped-for growth. The Shadow Justice Secretary Robert Jenrick has told Times Radio the benefits bill needs to fall to help balance the books, and the two-child welfare cap must remain.
The kind of people that I represent in North Nottinghamshire, hard-working people who are going out every morning to put food on the table for their kids, pay the mortgage, making responsible choices, maybe just have one kid, maybe to have two kids. Yeah. They would not want to see people with three, four, five kids getting thousands of pounds more in benefits, making the benefits bill even bigger at a time when we should be trying to bring it down.
Talks between the US and Russia held this morning were useful and constructive, according to Kremlin aide Yuri Ushakov. US envoy Steve Witkoff and Vladimir Putin met in Moscow. Their discussion is said to have lasted almost 3 hours. A survivor of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima says we're now in the most dangerous era since World War II. Toshiyuki Mimaki was 3 when the US dropped a nuclear bomb on Japan 80 years ago today.
In the future, you never know when they might use it. Russia, Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, Israel, Iran. We've been appealing for a world without war or nuclear weapons, but they're not listening.
He won a Nobel Peace Prize last year for his work alongside other survivors. He's urging nuclear powers to never use the weapons again. Here, sales of convertible cars have reached a 25-year low, with people ditching drop-tops in favour of SUVs. Back in the early 2000s, Britain was the convertible capital of Europe, with almost 95,000 registered every year. Last year, it was just over 12,000. The Times' transport correspondent, Ben Clatworthy, says it's quite the U-turn.
We're the fifth rainiest country on average in Europe, and yet the only country that ever rivaled sales of convertible cars was Germany. The UK was normally the leader in people wanting to buy convertible cars for presumably those rare sunny days like we've had this summer.
And the woman charged with selling Friendstar Matthew Perry the drug that killed him will appear in court next month. The actor died from a ketamine overdose in October 2023 at the age of 54. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So hopefully we've got a lovely hour lined up for you. Our big interview after 3:30 is with Adrian Dunbar. If you'd like to get some questions in, we will happily put them to him. I bumped into Times Radio's superstar breakfast presenter, Kate McCann, this morning on the way into the building. She was thrilled that Adrian Dunbar's on the programme, and she said she might text in herself. So if Kate can do it, so can you. It's 0333 003 2353. Chris Stokel-Walker will be here in about a quarter of an hour to talk about tech news, and we are trying to find out for you a little bit more about what's happened at Birmingham Airport. First, though, talks between Vladimir Putin and the US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff this afternoon have been very productive, according to Russian officials. Mr. Witkoff is in Moscow with just 2 days ahead of Donald Trump's deadline for a ceasefire in Ukraine. The US president has warned he'll introduce further sanctions and tariffs against Russia and its partners if it continues to bomb Ukraine. Mr. Trump claimed while campaigning that he'd end the war in Ukraine on day one, and he has become increasingly frustrated with his Russian counterpart's refusal to end the fighting. Let's talk to Yaroslav Trofimov, who is the Wall Street Journal's chief foreign affairs correspondent. What do you think will actually come out of these talks? How do we interpret very productive?
Well, I mean, we already have an answer because about 8 minutes ago, the White House announced that it's imposing an additional 25% tariff on India related to the purchases of Russian oil. And India is buying about 40%, 38% to be more precise, of Russian oil exports. So I guess the talks in Moscow between the U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and President Putin were not as constructive as Russia makes it out to be. It doesn't look like there was any breakthrough. Russia continues to refuse the ceasefire that Ukraine has accepted in this war. And so we're now seeing the first consequences of this. Let's see if there will be additional steps. But, 25% tariff on all Indian exports related to the Indian purchases of Russian oil is a very serious incentive for India to stop buying, or at least to dramatically reduce its purchases of Russian oil, which would be an important cost for the Russian economy and Russia's ability to prosecute the war.
Do you believe that that will be enough? I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, how little we really know about what is left in the war chest for Russia. We will never know, will we? And so trying to then work out what the leverage is on a tariff such as the one on India, I mean, it is difficult.
I think President Putin is determined to keep going with his campaign. His goals have not changed since the beginning of the war. It's we've seen it from the Russian proposals at the peace talks with Ukraine and Turkey a couple of months ago. His goal is the elimination of Ukraine as an independent state. And I think he believes that he can still achieve that. The Russian armies are advancing very slowly at tremendous cost in lives and treasure, but still slowly advancing in Ukraine. And I think the calculation in the Kremlin is that Russia can withstand these and other sanctions and eventually prevail.
But do you think that it can?
Well, so far, you know, Russia has been on the offensive for nearly 2 years. It gained less than 1% of Ukrainian territory. So Ukraine has proven to be adaptable, resilient, and able to resist the Russian onslaughts. So far, you know, as far as Ukraine is concerned, you know, there is no prospect for a strategic Russian breakthrough anywhere in the front lines. And as long as the flow of Western weapons continues, and President Trump has now agreed to supply weapons to Ukraine, Ukraine can keep resisting for years to come.
Where do you put the current relationship between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump? There was, it wasn't a love-in, but it was definitely warmth between them at the start of Trump's term, but that changed. Slurs were bandied around that Putin was mad. He seemed to be playing Trump. Where are we today?
Well, you know, President Trump thought that he could offer what he considered to be a reasonable deal to President Putin to end the war, which involved Ukraine ceding large parts of his territory and other very painful concessions by Kiev. But that wasn't enough. So President Putin refused that proposal. He refused the demand of an immediate ceasefire that Ukraine accepted. And I think President Trump now is upset. He's upset that his lack of ability to influence Putin at the continuation of the killing in Ukraine. And he's trying to impose costs on Russia. Let's see how far he will go and what sort of costs for the U.S. is he ready to accept it? Because obviously pressuring Russia economically will inevitably lead to a rise in the global prices of oil that will also have an impact on the American economy.
Do you think that there would ever come a time when there would be visible dissent in Russia because of the extreme poverty that some people live in, the extreme grief that some people have experienced losing their young sons and brothers and husbands to this war? Is there ever that type of tipping point coming?
Well, you know, never say never, obviously, but there are no signs of anything like that happening in Russia now. The Russian economy, all in all, is doing okay, considering the strains of the war. There seems to be no public dissent over the tremendous losses. Russia lost more than 1 million people in this war, soldiers killed and injured or maimed or missing. And the regime is become so totalitarian in its suppression of any form of public dissent that people just don't dare to criticize the war. You know, under the new legislation passed 3 years ago, discrediting the Russian armed forces in any form involves very lengthy prison terms. And so people just keep quiet. And there is this safety valve for the regime because Russia allows those who are not happy with the war to leave the country. And, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have left the country since the war began.
Yep. I mean, it is really worth concentrating on our minds on that unbelievable loss of life sometimes, isn't it? That is just so many often young lives gone, and in Ukraine, so many lives lost. Donald Trump does well to keep referencing that, doesn't he? Do you think that he, I don't want to say does he genuinely care, but do you think that he spends a lot of time thinking about that personal loss of life?
Well, I'm not sure how much time he spends thinking about this, but he clearly keeps mentioning this quite often. And I think, you know, he watches TV a lot. He sees these scenes of destruction in cities like Kiev. And, you know, President Putin has in recent months really adopted the policy of deliberately targeting civilian population centers, especially in the Ukrainian capital, kind of a repeat of the Blitz of London, attempting to create panic and to create dissent. That's not working for him, but it is creating these scenes that are having an impact on American foreign policy, as we can see it with President Trump, who, you know, really saw his relationship with Ukraine through the prism of his sometimes very difficult relationship with President Zelensky, but now seems to have a degree of empathy towards ordinary Ukrainians and as he watches their plight on television.
Can we just talk a little bit about Vladimir Putin? He is a man who needs to come out of every situation looking powerful, looking in control, and looking victorious to his people. Can you see that there is a way that he could ever be given an opportunity to retain some of that patina of victory, whilst at the same time giving the Ukrainian people what they want? Is there a way that you could ever make this man admit that he was wrong, retreat from the war, but allow him to still tell a story that he wants to tell?
Well, he's obviously never going to, he's never going to admit that he was wrong, but there are ways of ending this war for him that a lot of people say face. And, you know, Ukraine has agreed to an unconditional ceasefire that would freeze the front line and allow Putin, at least for the foreseeable future, to keep about 18% of Ukrainian territory that he already controls. Russia refuses that because Russia wants much more. And I think it's no longer an issue of Putin needing to save face or have legitimacy. He has legitimacy. You know, the Russian state system is so strong, the suppression is so high, that there is no challenge to his authority. But he sees himself as a historical figure along the lines of, you know, Emperor Peter the Great, and he thinks that his mission in life is to regain the glory of the empire and reconquer lands that, you know, were foolishly lost under Gorbachev when the Soviet Union collapsed. And I think that's what's driving him. He is a man on the mission. He sees himself as one of the greats of Russian history, and he doesn't mind the cost.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Yaroslav Trofimov, who is the Wall Street Journal's chief foreign affairs correspondent.
Now, the news at 3 o'clock did feature some information about an incident at the airport in Birmingham. It's just worth saying that it is thought to involve a light aircraft and the runway is likely to stay shut in Birmingham until this evening, around about 6 o'clock tonight. So we'll have more on that incident for you before 4 o'clock this afternoon. And before three, we were talking to Claire Girarda about the doctor strikes and about sometimes just how tough it can be to be a young doctor in 2025. And Sue has messaged to say, I just couldn't agree more with the points made by Claire Girarda. My young resident doctor daughter, who is committed and hardworking, has had the most terrible experiences, not knowing where her next placement is going to be until very shortly before. She can be on call at night, given a bed with bed bugs and no way of locking the door. There's nowhere to get a meal and nowhere to put her things. I could go on. These issues surely must be able to be solved with better organisation and management. Sue, thank you for that and our very best wishes to your daughter. You can WhatsApp the programme on 0333 003 2353. Adrian Dunbar is our guest after 3:30. Kate McCann incredibly has sent her a series of questions.
Fantastic questions.
And she's never off duty.
She isn't. And half of them are political. And we will talk about that because actually he did an interview with The Times last weekend where he did say that he was going with his daughter to see Kneecap. So maybe he's already been and done that and we can talk about that. But a great question from Kate as well. Would he want to be the next Bond?
Okay, yeah, well, I'm going to see if you put those questions.
Will you remind me? Well, don't let them slip.
You'll have to owe Kate money, won't you, if you use them? Strictly speaking, it's her work, isn't it?
Right, eat more of your chocolate bar.
No, I can't eat a Twizzle now because I've got to say this.
Get your blood sugar back up.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is our podcast. It comes out every Monday to Thursday. And what are we discussing in today's breathtaking edition? Well, we're still on Mariah Carey's Denial of Time. I think we'll be speaking about that for all time. Also, a very rich scene we're mining, the multiple ailments of Karen Slaughter's cat, and indeed your thoughts on that. Blue Tits, the bird, that is. And the difference between Paxos, the relatively remote Greek island, and Paxo, the easy-to-use British stuffing. Now, you can hear all of our 3:30 interviews in full during Off Air. We have featured lately the brilliant Max Hastings, Janet Street Porter, she was brilliant too, and Gary Newman, who was lovely and was on the programme last week. We also talked recently to the journalist, the former editor of The Mirror, Alison Phillips, who is a good friend of the TV presenter Fiona Phillips, and helped to write Fiona's memoir, Remember When. Now, Fiona Phillips was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2022. Both of Fiona's parents had had the disease too, and Fiona herself had worked as an ambassador for Alzheimer's UK. So Alison Phillips told us that Fiona always felt that Alzheimer's was coming for her.
Yeah, she was sort of an ambassador for them for a long time, and she put so much effort. I mean, that's what's the sort of terrible irony of all this, is that she did all this work to help people with Alzheimer's and to raise awareness of Alzheimer's. And then it came for... So I remember talking to her very soon after her father had died. So that was 2012. And she said to me, the clock is ticking. I know it's coming for me. And of course, when somebody says something to you like that, you go, don't be silly, it'll be fine. What, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. And of course, it was coming for her.
Alison Phillips talking there about a conversation she'd had with Fiona Phillips. Alison helped to write Fiona's book, Remember When, and we should say, actually, it is currently, I think, Britain's best-selling hardback non-fiction book.
It is in at number one, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not at all surprised because it was an incredibly powerful, powerful read. You can download Off Air with Jane and Fee. There are loads, hundreds of episodes. If you like one, I mean, you've got a hobby pretty much for life. You could go on that spaceship for 250 years and you wouldn't run... You wouldn't, terrifyingly, you almost certainly wouldn't run out of editions of Off Air with Jane and Fee.
But what would happen to your brain?
Oh, well, yes, it's possibly not a really good recommendation. Anyway, it's Off Air with Jane and Fee. You can get it in your local podcast shop.
Everything's computer.
Yes, it is. Let's bring in our tech expert. It's Chris Stoker-Walker. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Jane.
Right, now we're going to start with... actually, this is something serious, and I've got to say, I find this really disturbing. It's Jim Acosta, who used to be somebody very prominent at CNN. He was the White House correspondent for CNN. And he has made public an interview he's done with an AI version of a victim of a mass shooting. This, in this case, is the Parkland shooting. And it's caused quite a stir. And, Chris, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, this is a supposed interview with what Jim Acosta is saying is Joaquin Oliver. And this is an AI bot, a video and also text outputting bot that could do a live interview. It was set up by the relatives of Joaquin Oliver, which means that we have to be obviously very sensitive in terms of how we talk about this, because this is the family of someone who was gunned down in a school shooting, deciding that it is important that their relatives' voices put out there. But it is a little bit of a sideshow and a little bit concerning in terms of the idea that this AI avatar can somehow represent a once living person and reanimate their voices and their thoughts post-mortem. It's an unsettling watch and listen to kind of see and listen to. I would recommend people do, in part because it highlights some of the concerns that we are going to see in the near future, where these systems can be so powerful that you can have lifelike representations. But it's important to say these are lifelike. This is not a real interview. This is not this person's real thoughts. This is an AI approximation of what someone who might have been through this says, with a kind of very good-looking veneer that perhaps might give this family some closure, but ultimately does very little beyond that.
Okay. I mean, have you seen it yourself, Chris?
I have, yeah. It's uncanny, but also you kind of think I am intruding on something here. You cannot interview victims of mass shootings who are no longer alive. Unfortunately, you know, the job of journalism is to interview people who have been through some of these horrific things when they are still there, but ultimately anything beyond that, I think, is dabbling in the world of fiction somewhat.
Yeah, and there are plenty of critics of what Jim Acosta has done, and I think many people making the same point, which is that if you really care about this issue, and frankly, who doesn't, then try to interview and give time to people who have survived these mass shootings.
And you know, there is a way that the family here are speaking out through this, which is important to acknowledge. And Jim Acosta did interview the father of Joaquin, Manuel, as well, alongside this. But it's, to me at least, and I understand where the family are coming from, and I probably can understand why Jim Acosta did it, it feels a little bit tasteless. And you know, we have seen this before. We spoke several months ago about a court case where this was allowed. A victim impact statement was given life and voice through an AI reanimation of something similar. The judge there said that that wasn't actually something that affected their decision making in terms of the sentence that was given to a victim of a kind of particularly gory incident, but actually you know, it was given to allow the family some element of having their own voice. But yeah, be careful when you use AI, I think is important to say.
Right, which brings us to the Swedish Prime Minister, who is Ulf Kristersson, and he has come in for quite a bit of criticism after he confessed to regularly relying on AI tools for a so-called second opinion. What exactly has he done?
He's basically peppering ChatGPT with questions to decide whether or not his policy decisions would play well with the general public. And in some ways, I can't discount Ulf Kristersson doing this, because, you know, ChatGPT and other AI tools like it can give you a good approximation of a broad swathe of people, which ultimately is what we might in a previous era have called political focus groups or political polling. The challenge is that, again, they are not real people. So Kristersson here is saying that he will often use this for a second opinion to see what should we have done, to try and take devil's advocate positions and to say, well, actually, are the decisions that I'm making right or wrong? The problem here, I suppose, is twofold. Number one, the voters who voted him in are saying, well, we voted for you because you make decisions. And when you get put in a position of power like this, we expect you to take ownership of those decisions that you make and to have the kind of moral clarity to go through with that yourself. The other one is a real concern, which is if you are feeding this stuff into a chatbot, who's to say who is listening and where that data ends up, particularly if you're talking about major decisions at a country level in terms of this. You might be feeding in classified information. You might be doing something that is not necessarily something that you would want either a political opponent or, frankly, just a random tech company like OpenAI to listen in on and to hear about.
This is just mind-boggling. Do you think he would have said, hello, I'm the Swedish Prime Minister, and actually introduced himself and then posed the question?
I would think so, in large part because we have precedent for this. Again, our listeners will remember, Jane, that I caused a little bit of trouble with the UK government several months ago when I managed to obtain the same sort of conversations that Peter Kyle, our technology secretary, was having. Now, his were much more banal. He was asking what podcast he should appear on. Fortunately, again, did not have off-air. I think that's a real shame, because it would have been good for him to learn the difference between Paxos and Paxo. But anyway, that is...
There's still time for him.
Don't have a roast round at his house.
No, exactly. You might get some sort of souvlaki-flavoured whatever, or I don't know quite what. But anyway, the point is, he did exactly the same. He said, I'm the technology secretary
of
the United
Kingdom. So he said it. I mean, it really does make me laugh that maybe even now, as we speak, leaders of the world are engaging with their devices and just prefacing everything with, help me out, I'm currently the Prime Minister of blank, and I've got no idea what to do. I mean, this is terrifying.
I don't know what that says more about, Jane, whether it says more about the power of this technology and the way that AI is changing the world, or whether it says something about the calibre of the politicians that we currently have. That might be something that we can discuss ad infinitum for then weeks and months to come.
There's no suggestion that the Swedish Prime Minister is going to stop doing this, then?
No, he's basically said this is sensible. He said that this is something that is second nature to me now. It's important that I do it. What's interesting also is that Sweden is relatively AI forward in its thinking. There is a initiative that is going on at the minute, which sees around about 2.3 million Swedes being given free access to a similar AI system in order to kind of improve their thinking to see whether or not it might be useful for them. That's echoing a previous initiative that the country had in the 1990s, which gave PC access to individuals back when that was a relative rarity, in an attempt to try and stoke innovation to get people thinking about this sort of stuff.
Let's talk about YouTube, which believes it should be treated the same as broadcasters in terms of ads or other... Do you tell me what's going on here? The Lib Dems are intervening on this one.
Yeah, the Lib Dems want YouTube to be considered the same as broadcast TV, which is a valid thing to ask for, to be honest, because obviously we saw Ofcom coming out last week with its annual report saying that actually YouTube was the second most watched source of information behind the BBC, leapfrogged ITV in the last year. And so the Lib Dems here are pointing out, and obviously this is, we have to bear in mind, summer season, and so some of these smaller parties will get more play for what they say as the government and Parliament goes into recess. But the Lib Dems effectively are saying, well, if YouTube is this important, if it is this large, if it has this outsized impact on our culture and our entertainment ecosystem, then it is important that it is held to the same standard. So they have spotted that on YouTube. You will often see, either before a video or during a video, those pre-roll or mid-roll ads, some stuff that is advertised as perhaps not necessarily as legitimate as you might hope on a TV commercial. So things like, you know, crash diet pills or fake celebrity endorsements. Martin Lewis is often seen as kind of a figurehead for this stuff, where deep faked versions of him will hawk Bitcoin products or things like that. They say that more needs to be done to try and stop that, and that YouTube should really be considered equivalent to broadcast TV when it comes to actually policing those adverts in a way that stops users from falling foul of them.
Now, two Chinese nationals in the States, in California, have been arrested, and they've been charged with illegally shipping tens of millions of dollars worth of AI chips to China. Now, the chips they were trying to get to China, would they be so that the Chinese could work on cheaper replicas of these chips, or what was going on here?
It's probably a little bit of column A, Jane, in terms of that, but then also just fundamentally to actually power the AI systems that China is developing. So this is very much a gold rush at the minute. We know AI systems are being developed by all different types of countries for the purposes of benefiting their population, but they need these computer chips, these GPUs, graphical processing units, to work. And NVIDIA is one company that produces many of those, the world's most valuable company, more than $4 trillion valuation right now. The problem is that they are barred presently from exporting some of their highest technology-skilled chips to China because Donald Trump and others are worried about giving them that kind of technological prowess. So there has been an illicit black market that has developed in the last sort of year or so, where these chips are finding their way to China. The US is obviously cracking down on this and saying that actually, you know, these Chinese nationals have been alleged to have sort of shipped many of these chips, tens of millions of dollars worth. Now, truthfully, that might not be that many chips because these things are really expensive individually. But it is still a significant load of these that are going to China outside of the auspices of the United States.
And just how big is a single AI chip?
They're pretty small. So you can hold them in your hands relatively simply. It's when you start to add them up that they compound. Really interesting, and really briefly, Jane, the GPU, the graphical processing unit, the clue is in the name. It originally developed in the 1990s as a way of playing games on laptops. You might remember back then, PCs and video games were the sort of auspices only of consoles rather than computers. And so they were meant to sort of handle the ability to render these graphics in very high fidelity and very quickly. Turns out that actually they were also really useful for doing the simultaneous calculations that are required to power these AI systems. So turned NVIDIA into a real behemoth and also set up this kind of massive AI revolution that we've seen now.
Thank you very much, Chris. Chris Stokel-Walker, who is our tech expert, and he features on the programme every Wednesday.
Isn't the use of AI by a prime minister only dubious and dodgy if the prime minister then takes that advice? Isn't it exactly the same as being briefed by a SPAD? And you could argue that, at least with a computer, they're not hungover, they're not sycophantically ambitious, they're not coming from a certain driven
perspective. They haven't done PPE at Oxford.
They haven't done PPE at Oxford, or brought in a karaoke machine and too much booze
in a suitcase.
In a suitcase late at night. So are we just on the frontier of something that we are mistrustful of now, but we'll look back and go, well, it's not that different?
I just want my prime minister to think for themselves. I suppose it's all right to ask for a second opinion.
Sorry, you want your prime minister to think for themselves?
I do, yes. Call me old-fashioned. People have.
Right, coming up, Adrian Dunbar is going to delight us with his presence. Any questions, do get him in as quick as you can. 0333 003 2353. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio. It's just gone 3:30.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
This is Andy Hayes with the latest headlines. Good afternoon. The runway at Birmingham Airport is closed because of what's described as an aircraft incident. Pictures show a twin-engined plane thought to be a Beech King Air, and its landing gear appears to have collapsed. All arrivals and departures have been stopped until 6 p.m. The airport's apologised for any inconvenience caused to passengers.
The Prime Minister is playing down a report suggesting that major tax rises will be needed in the next budget. The Chancellor has been warned she'll need to find £41 billion in extra cash to meet her own fiscal rules by 2930. Sir Keir Starmer, on a visit to Milton Keynes, says the government will set out its plans in the autumn budget, but he's not ruling out higher taxes.
Some of the figures put out are not figures that I recognise, but what's really important is that I'm very clear about our focus on living standards and making sure that people feel better off, partly because more money is coming into their pocket in the first place, partly because we're bearing down on costs like mortgages.
And a man's been jailed for at least 25 years for the murder of a grandmother on an early morning dog walk in Suffolk. Anita Rose was found with serious injuries in Brantham last July and died 4 days later in hospital. Prosecutors say 56-year-old Roy Barclay subjected her to numerous kicks, stamps and blows, describing him as irrational and dangerous. And you can hear detailed analysis of the biggest developments in global security on our World in 10 podcast.
This is Times Radio. You've worked hard to build your business, so it's important it's properly protected. At NFU Mutual, our tradesman insurance has received a 5-star rating by Defaqto for the past 10 years. No wonder 9 out of 10 of our business insurance customers renew every year. With agency offices across the UK, we're closer to you, closer to your business, closer to what matters. Search NFU Mutual Builders and Trades Insurance.
At Kia, we're excited to announce that the refined new Kia Sportage is available in showrooms now. Secure your test drive today to explore its advanced technology and stylish, sporty design. Order before the 30th of September to get 5.9% APR representative and £1,000 PCP finance deposit contribution. Search the new Kia Sportage to book your test drive. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as Saints, could help. Saints has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. Saints is managed by Bailey Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baileygifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
The day's big stories and tomorrow's front pages, Saturday and Sunday nights from 10 p.m. with Daryl Morris.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Adrian Dunbar is just minutes away, but we said we'd update you on what's been going on at Birmingham Airport. It has closed its one and indeed only runway following what has been described as an aircraft incident. Let's talk to Times Travel Commissioning Editor Claudia Rowan. So what do you know about this, Claudia?
So it's a breaking news story. We don't have that many details yet. The airport shut around an hour ago after what's thought to be a private Beech King Air aircraft that was headed for Belfast, made an emergency landing, and all flights have stopped until 6 p.m. And we don't know much more than that, but it's likely to affect hundreds of passengers.
Busy time of year.
It's a very busy time of year,
I understand, in fact, that the website at the airport has crashed completely. It's just
it
gone
is.
Down.
I actually went on it a few minutes ago myself to check how many flights had been cancelled, and nothing came up.
So, I mean, forgive me if you don't know the answer to this. If you are supposed to be flying out of Birmingham, do you go to the airport?
So the airport has actually issued a statement advising passengers already at the airport to just stay tuned to the latest news, and that anyone planning on travelling should check the status of their flight before coming to the airport. So just check with your airline, you know, they will issue some advice.
Claudia, thank you very much. That is Claudia Rowan, Times Travel Commissioning Editor.
It's just coming up to 24 minutes to four. Adrian Dunbar has fixed his place in the firmament of stars on our screen with his performances in Hear My Song and Line of Duty, and on stage in Kiss Me, Kate. And now we can treat ourselves to more Ridley on ITV, second series up now, where Adrian plays a cop with a tragic past, sorting out the criminal fraternity of a northern town. Adrian, you're very welcome on the programme and the podcast. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. I've just... I'm just back from 3 weeks in the northwest of Ireland, where it has to be said wasn't as warm as it was here when I left. But on the other hand, we had some fabulous skies and wonderful empty beaches to walk on. And, yeah, thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Well, I hate to drag you back into the world of work from what sounds like an idyllic break, but let's talk about Ridley. Tell us just a little bit more about what has happened to your character's family, because actually it's incredibly tragic, isn't it?
It is a very tragic start to the whole story, given that his wife and daughter both die in a tragic fire. And that, in series one, the reasons for that and the whys and the wherefores for that were played out. And now we find him in season two, a couple of years on. I wanted to show some movement with him in terms of the grief, obviously, that he's carrying. But at the same time, it opens with a conversation about that in episode one, but very quickly gets on to him getting called back in. There's a burglary. There's then a murder, and that leads to a kind of criminal gang investigation. But there's a young woman who's implanted from the police, and there's this kind of thing which is when you lose, sometimes you can't believe you've lost someone. And in a way, Ridley can't believe he's lost his daughter. He can reconcile himself to the fact that his wife is gone, but he feels it very, very difficult, the idea of losing his daughter. I knew someone at one point in my life who had lost his daughter in a car accident, but couldn't get over it and kept thinking that he was going to turn a corner and she'd be there. It was very unstable. It was an unstable place for his mind to be. And we kind of echo this in episode one, where for a second, Ridley believes that the girl he's looking at may be his daughter. It's a very strange condition. But that sort of happening in episode one, along with a number of other things, of course, which is that John Mickey joins our cast, playing the guy who owns the jewellery shop. He then has an eye for Julie Graham. Surprisingly.
Now, do you know what? As soon as he comes on the screen, Adrian, I'm thinking you're a chancer, aren't you? There's just something about it. It's the jewellery shop. I think he may be wearing slip-on shoes. I think he's driving a Jaguar car. All the signs are there.
Yes. Well done, yeah. No, you're absolutely right. John is absolutely, he's fantastic in the role. And of course, you know, you think, oh, come on, Ridley, you know. You can't just go chasing this guy down thinking he's got something to do with it, that it's an inside job. Surely the real reason you're annoyed is because he's kind of making eyes at Annie. So therefore there's that running through it. And we have our fabulous songs from Richard Hawley. We also have, you know, Brona Waugh and George Bakari and all the wonderful actors who are within the police department. So, yeah.
There's a lot going on. And, Adrian, for people who've not seen the first series, do you want to just explain about the songs? Because your character sings. We know that you can really sing. And this is really woven into the series, isn't it, in the form of a jazz club?
Yeah, it is. Well, the idea was, listen, we're going to be shooting this in the winter north of Manchester, up in the, you know, up in the hills, which will be pretty cold and it's going to look a bit desolate. We should have somewhere warmer to take the audience every Sunday. And we come up with the idea of the jazz club, of the music, that this was something he was organising with Annie for his retirement. And I suggested that, well, why doesn't he get up now and again and do a song? That's what he was always wanting to do. Why doesn't he keep doing that? And The big stroke of luck we had was realizing that Richard Hawley's songs in particular suit the character really well. Richard writes these amazing songs. Most of them are dealing with male grief and they sort of suit the program really well. But also in over the 90 minutes, they give you a great chance to compress time. And so when we play the songs, which spookily do tend to throw some resonance on the story itself, they also compress time, which is brilliant in a TV show.
You're known for your singing, and you can really sing, and it's been your passion since you were very young. Take us back to the days of Breeze in Northern Ireland? Or was it The Breeze, which was an original band you were in? The Breeze. Yeah, forgive me, Breeze. Adrian,
yeah,
forgive
we
me.
That radical, just saying Breeze. Yeah.
Well, that was a bit 2025 of me, wasn't it? What kind of music did you play? And did you hope to really make it as a band?
No, I don't think there was any kind of hope to make it there. It was just a fabulous thing when you're 15 and 16 to be with two of your mates, you know, travelling out to kind of local pubs and playing country music, because we were into country music way before it became fashionable. So we liked people like Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson and Merle Haggard and Hank Snow, you know, and before all these guys, you know, became, you know, suddenly popular in the last 20 years, we were listening to them because we lived in the country. We lived in a country town. People liked country music. So that's where I started. And it was great fun. You know, you were getting paid. You know, you can afford to buy yourself a pair of jeans on the Saturday night. Now and again, you know, it was like kind of the first, you know, our first gigs. And then beyond that, then I went and played with a guy called Frank Chisholm, who was an Elvis Presley impersonator. And I played bass guitar and sang backing vocals with Frank. We played all over Ireland. We had a great time playing, you know, and people love Presley songs, you know, and they come out to dance to them. And we actually went to New York in about 1979. We played in Dirty Nelly's in the Bronx. It was quite an interesting time to be in New York, as you can imagine. And, you know, so then I came back and I was interested in amateur dramatics at the time, locally. And I got an audition to the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. And as luck would have it, I got in. And that was the...
No, luck's got nothing to do with Adrian. It's pure talent, pure talent.
Oh, yeah.
Did your music, when you were with The Breeze, carry any kind of a political message? Music across Ireland and Northern Ireland often does, and for good reason, on both sides.
No, that was not a period to be playing political music, especially in the kind of through the 70s. You know, you did not want to alienate any audience you were playing with. And so therefore, we just played straight country music, what people like to hear in bars. You know, people, their lives were tough enough. They were living under enough stress without being reminded of what was happening outside. And so therefore, you know, when they came to a bar and they came to the pub to hear music, it was to get away from it all, really. Mm.
I know that you did an interview with the Times newspaper, which was out last weekend, where you mentioned that you were going to see Kneecap with your daughter, excited by the prospect. Do you think that the BBC was wrong not to stream their Glastonbury performance?
Were they wrong not to stream it? I don't know. I think that's a question for the BBC, not for me. But I do think that everybody got too heated about them. You know, I think everybody jumped to conclusions about them. I think, they're a band, they're good musicians, they make great music, they're promoting the Irish language, they're very clear about who they support and who they don't support. And, we had a great time there. But, you know, those decisions are for the BBC.
OK. It was a very interesting piece that you did, Adrian, and you did also say in it something that I think might stick with me for a very long time, just talking about the passage that men go through in their lives and the mental health of men. You said men don't have these staging posts through their lives where they know they're progressing as a person the way that a woman does. And I wonder whether you'd tell us a little bit more about that observation and maybe what that's meant to you.
Well, I suppose, I did a lot of research in the early 90s on alternative medicine. And so I read a lot, and I read a lot of stuff that was coming out of something that was called the men's movement at the time. And one of the things that they talked about was that, you know, women go through these three definite stages of their lives where they progress. And a lot of it has got to do with pain. And pain does tend to make you articulate. Whereas in primitive societies, they realize that boys don't necessarily do this. I mean, you know, the birth of your first child is fabulous and, you know, doing things like going to war might be seen as rites of passage, but really there isn't one for young men. And so therefore primitive societies invented one where at the age of 12, 13, 14, they'd drag the young boys away from their mothers and they'd put them through various trials and so forth. And at the end of it, they would say, right, that's it. You're a man now. You're moving on into your life and you're going to have different responsibilities. But I think men kind of have this, they deal with grief. They don't know where it's coming from. It's kind of this amorphous thing that they all have. It tends to make them inarticulate. And I think I just think there's something in that. I think there's something to talk about there and to think about. And maybe we have to find ways to, if you like, initiate young boys to make them realise that they're crossing a threshold in some way.
Yeah. Do you feel like a very different man now you're older to the man that you were when you were younger?
Oh, yeah, yes, yes. I'm glad to say that, I have been on some on a journey. You know, I'm glad to say that I feel I've changed as a person. Initially, coming from the background that I came from and so forth, everything was just great because everything was a progression. And then eventually you get to a place where you don't feel that you're progressing, that life hasn't got CVs tend to be, and then I did, and then I did, and they leave out all the bits where it's really difficult and you're struggling. And I think that those things, you know, the bits where you struggle and the bits that you have to overcome a bit of adversity are the things that kind of change you and, turn you into someone else. Hopefully, maybe more sensitive, more understanding, those elements that need to come into your life for you to progress as a person.
And what would the younger Adrian Dunbar think of the older Adrian Dunbar being regarded as a real sex symbol?
I think you'd find him very funny. And, I think basically just find it funny. It's the only thing you can do, really.
How does that manifest itself? I mean, is there a woman of a certain age who sees you in a supermarket and just faints?
Yes, no, you you tend to know your demographic, don't you?
It's us. What is it that makes you so brilliant at being a good cop in a bad place?
Who gave you that question? That's my question. A good cop in a bad place. I don't know. I think Jed Mercurio's got quite a lot to do with it. he wrote a character at a time when, and it's, you know, still feels a bit like it, there's a paucity in professional life of the understanding of civic duty. And, the idea that there was someone there like Ted Hastings who was prepared to do the right thing, at a difficult time, I think appealed to people. I think people appreciated the fact that someone had written a character who was willing to put their, put their job and put, their morals and put, first and foremost, and sometimes against the detriment to themselves.
Yeah. But and can you tell us any more about when Line of Duty might hit our screens again? I mean, it's not been definitively recommissioned by the BBC, has it?
No, it hasn't been definitive. There's nothing definitive about it. We get these questions every day. Is it coming back? You know, and they're great questions and they're kind questions. They come from the fans. And so, rather like everybody, I hear rumours and things and, and I hear, oh, right, okay. that's a bit of news there or a bit of news here. But ultimately, you know, and yet you want to give the fans some hope that it's coming back. But I think I just checked with my agent this morning and there is really no definitive news on Line of Duty.
Okay. Well, we're just going to pretend that you haven't said that and just carry on the hoping and hoping for it to emerge. I'm going to read you a couple of text messages that we've got from our shared demographic here, Adrian. Tracy says, what is it about that velvety, seductive Irish voice that is pure catnip? Please pass me the smelling salts. And Mary says, are you still with us, Tracy? And Mary says, please tell Adrian I've loved him since I first saw him in Hear My Song, a wonderful movie from the 90s. Joseph Locke was my father's favourite singer. Oh. My father's party piece was always I'll Take You Home, Kathleen, which was also my mother's name. Great memories. So how fantastic is that?
Yeah,
You've got Ridley then up on the ITV at the moment. It's interesting, isn't it, Adrian, that we're told that we've got shortened attention spans and TikTok's only 3 minutes long and all that kind of stuff. But actually, the feature-length episode, and they are feature-length episodes each time, have proved to be incredibly popular.
Yeah, they really work. Well, they give us a chance to develop stories. You know, usually within the hour format, you're getting the kind of who, why, where and what, and the actual, you know, the scaffolding of a kind of a crime. Whereas, you know, with the extra half hour and the compression that the songs allow us to do, it really does feel like, you know, you're getting your meat and potatoes and your dessert for it. It's a really good evening. And we can develop storylines with the individual characters, how they feel about each other. Yeah, it really does work.
Now, Kate McCann, who is our superstar breakfast show presenter here on Times Radio, was really thrilled to hear that you were on the station. She doesn't fit the demographic, actually. She's about half our age, apart from anything else. She's got a couple of questions for you. Is there anyone you wouldn't or couldn't play on screen? And she has put in brackets, Trump, question mark.
I don't know. Do I have the hair for it? I probably could.
Oh, I think you could. I think you could. You could waft that around quite nicely.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I think, there are certain characters who would just be too dark, I think, to attempt. Wouldn't like to go there.
Okay.
I admire the actors who do. I don't think I would. But yeah. I mean, that's probably about it. But, you know, everybody else you can have a go at, can't you? But, you know, you have to have something that you can bring to it. And I think, you know, people who are casting will always look to see if there's something that's quite close to you. I think that always helps.
Yes, and you might be quite far apart from Donald Trump. And do you want to be the next Bond?
Do I want to be the next Bond? No, that's a very tricky one. And I think Martin Compton should be the next Bond, to tell you the truth.
It's about time
we had another Scottish Bond. After Connery, I think Martin would be really good. And I just love the idea of him having to get down the gym.
Okay, right. It's so nice to talk to you, Adrian. Thank you very much indeed for your company this afternoon. I know that our listeners have really enjoyed it too. Adrian Dunbar, and if you want to catch Ridley, it is up there on Sunday nights, but it's all available as well on demand on ITVX.
Yeah. Who was the last? Who was the last Scottish James Bond?
Well, is Pierce Brosnan at all Scottish?
No.
So it would be Sean Connery.
Sean Connery, okay. Right.
Pierce Brosnan's Irish, yes, thank you.
Yeah. Give Lulu a go, that's what I say. It's 4 minutes to 4.
Early breakfast on Times Radio with Elavon. As a new day dawns, join Rosie Wright as she connects you with the latest breaking news and provides intelligent opinion on all the morning headlines.
Plus, get ahead of all the markets with updates, analysis and insight with my daily dedicated business bulletin.
Early Breakfast with Rosie Wright. Every Monday to Friday morning from 5 on Times Radio with Elavon. Your world of payments. Find out more at elavon.co.uk.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
When you run a small business, you know it's important to keep an eye on your costs, and a smart meter can help. Aaron Sarney's family own Twinkle Toes, the largest children's shoe retailer in Sheffield. He uses his smart meter to find ways to cut his energy costs.
Well, we chose to get a smart meter because what we didn't really know is what our daily consumption was, and so we just wanted to target, are there ways that we can actually go and see what we were using it on and that sort of thing. We have identified some areas where we've managed to save energy. The lights are used for 8 hours a day, so we can go and change the actual lighting to LED. And secondly, in the stockroom, for instance, if we introduce LED sensors, it will help reduce usage when no one's actually in the stockroom. Smart meter is a great tool. I would certainly recommend it to other businesses because it's certainly been a wonderful tool to help our business to actually understand our energy usage.
To find out more, search Get a Smart Meter for Business. Eligibility may vary.
What time is it?
8 a.m. and I've already meditated, stretched and been for a big run.
How?
It's my new Samsung Galaxy Watch 8 Classic. It's got sleep tracking and bedtime guidance to remind me when to go to bed, so I always wake up early and fresh.
And you made me coffee.
That's mine.
Oh. Buy the new Galaxy Watch 8 Classic today at Samsung.com. Requires smartphone on Android 11 or above with the latest version of the Samsung Health app, intended for general wellness and fitness purposes only.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Adrian Dunbar. If you missed any of that conversation with Adrian, you'll be able to hear it in Off Air with Jane and Fee, which will come your way at around about 6 o'clock. There's an edition of that. How would I describe it? That podcast, Monday to Thursday, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
Whether you like it or not, and many people don't. But some people do. Right, Callum McDonald awaits. We're not here tomorrow. Alexis Conran is. We're not here because we're going to the Fringe by the Sea, which I'm very much looking forward to.
We are. We're appearing at 11:30 in the Big Tent. Our guest is Judy Murray. There are still some tickets available if you'd like to come and join us. And that will be aired as one of our podcast episodes at a time to be decided. I don't know when.
People really guessing there. Okay. It's worth saying that our book club podcast comes out tomorrow. That is about the book we've mentioned a few times now, Leonard and Hungry Paul by Ronan Hessian, which I think just about everybody absolutely loved. We're discussing that in the podcast tomorrow. And on Friday, we're putting out a podcast edition, which features a conversation we had with an endocrinologist about HRT, which we recorded last week. We're putting that out on Friday, so hopefully that will answer some of your questions about when to take HRT, when to stop it.
But the main news to take from all of this is that we're not here tomorrow afternoon. You get a break from us, but we are available on all of those other channels. But Alexis Conran will see you through the afternoon. And here on Times Radio, Callum McDonald is next. Have a very good evening when you get to it. Our thanks today to Felix and to Ryan and to Keir and to Eve and to Rosie. It's amazing how many people it takes to make this.
Not all of them are hard at it the whole time, are they? Right, Callum is here.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Hello, good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. I'm Callum McDonald. In for John Pienaar, this is Times Radio Drive. The headlines: President Trump hits India with a 25% tariff for buying Russian oil as we await a real outcome of his envoy's meeting with Vladimir Putin. And the runway at Birmingham Airport is closed because of what's described as an aircraft incident. We'll bring you the latest. Also on the programme, what to make of today's US-Russia talks as Steve Witkoff heads back to the US, Trump's former national security advisor and a former aide of President Zelensky of Ukraine will give us their thoughts. And we'll get the state of the war on the ground as Donald Trump's deadline, latest deadline, for peace looms. We'll also find out why the US president is taking aim at funding for vaccines. And why are more Scottish young people choosing PE over learning a language?
This is Times Radio.
Right now, let's get the latest news. Here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Callum. Good afternoon.
Donald Trump has put an additional 25% tariff on goods from India, saying the country imports Russian oil directly or indirectly. It's on top of an initial 25%, making it now 50%. It means India will face the highest levy along with Brazil starting in 3 weeks' time. But some sectors, including electronics and pharmaceuticals, will be exempt from the additional rate. The Kremlin says talks between Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump's peace envoy have been useful and constructive. Discussions with Steve Witkoff in Moscow lasted 3 hours. The US president has threatened sweeping sanctions on Russia should Putin fail to end the war in Ukraine before Friday. Ukrainian MP Maria Mentsen-Sava thinks financial punishments could be effective.
It can be started by decision of a one person. It can be Putin. But his willingness is absent. I think international pressure, more sanctions can definitely stop him. So UK, EU, US have to join the efforts if we want democracy to flourish.
A man who murdered a grandmother on her morning dog walk while he was living off-grid to avoid being recalled to prison has been jailed for at least 25 years. 56-year-old Roy Barclay attacked Anita Rose in Brantham in Suffolk last June while she was walking her Springer Spaniel. He'd previously been jailed for an attack on another pensioner in 2015. Detective Chief Inspector Matthew Connick spoke outside court.
Our thoughts remain with Anita's partner, children and grandchildren who have endured an unimaginable year and have been forced to sit through weeks of painful evidence at trial. I hope today's sentencing brings a measure of justice to them all.
The runway at Birmingham Airport is closed because of what's described as an aircraft incident. Pictures show a twin-engined plane thought to be a Beech King Air, and its landing gear appears to have collapsed. All arrivals and departures have been stopped until 6 p.m. The airport has apologised for any inconvenience caused to passengers. Today is the 80th anniversary of the nuclear bomb dropped by the Allies on Hiroshima. About 55,000 people, including representatives from 120 nations, stood in Hiroshima's Peace Memorial Park near the hypo centre of the blast to remember the tens of thousands who died. Stephen Walker is the author of Shockwave, Countdown to Hiroshima, in which he interviewed a huge number of witnesses. He's told Times Radio how the young men in the plane saw themselves.
Largely, this was necessary. This had to be done. This ended the war. This saved lives. There's some very strong arguments to support that. I don't think it's quite as clear-cut as that, but there are some very strong arguments to support that. Is this some kind of psychological defence mechanism when you're confronted with the kind of horrible reality of what actually happened? Perhaps 250,000 people died, we'll never know the exact figure, in those two attacks. Or is it actually a mantra that they genuinely held on to because they believed it for the rest of their lives?
And remember, our news podcasts are on the Times Radio app. Look for the Times News Briefing and the World in 10.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Times Radio Drive with Barclays Business Banking.
Hello, good afternoon. It is 4 minutes past four on Wednesday afternoon, the 6th of August. Welcome to Times Radio Drive. This is Callum McDonald here while John Pienaar is on holiday. Thank you so much for being with us. Today, Steve Witkoff, a real estate tycoon turned presidential envoy, met Vladimir Putin in Moscow for 3 hours, just 2 days before President Trump's ceasefire ultimatum expires. Just think about that for a moment. A billionaire developer with no formal diplomatic background is now the chief negotiator in what may be the most consequential geopolitical standoff of our time. He's had 5 trips to Russia this year alone. The stakes? Well, nothing less than the end, or the deepening of a war that has devastated Ukraine for more than 3 years. Trump's deadline is looming. By August the 8th, Putin must agree to ceasefire terms or face new sweeping sanctions. And these will not just be on Russia, but on countries that buy from it. China is up there. India today has faced an extra 25% tariff, as announced by President Trump within the last hour or so. Another Trump shockwave is only days away. And yet, as of now, we don't have a public readout of what happened in this meeting, only hints from Moscow. A Kremlin aide has called the meeting constructive. Make of that what you will. On one hand, it's a rare sign, I suppose, of direct engagement. On the other, is it just diplomatic theatre? Exciting and dramatic? Absolutely. Another episode in the current series of The Trump Files. But is it all hollow? If Putin truly believes the war is tilting in his favour, why on earth would he concede now? If he offers something resembling a limited airstrike pause, does that count as progress? Or is it another of his now classic strategic delays? Ukraine, the country's future hangs in the balance, waits. So can diplomacy, delivered by a businessman and his businessman boss, outpace the death and destruction being inflicted on Ukraine? Today's meeting in Moscow may be remembered as a turning point or another missed opportunity. We don't yet know. What we do know is that time is surely running out, the world is watching, and we know that we will bring you the latest this afternoon. This is Callum MacDonald. Welcome to Times Radio Drive. Today we'll also be considering why school pupils are choosing PE over modern languages and learning how to ask for directions to the train station, just in French. And we'll be looking ahead to tomorrow, where an interest rate cut from the Bank of England looks likely to be announced. You can have your say on all we're discussing this afternoon. Text us, 87222 is the number. Start your message with the word Times, or you can WhatsApp us, and the number there is 0333 003 2353. So it's been just over a week since this.
Yesterday, you mentioned that you would change the Russia deadline to 10 to 12 days. Has that started yet? Or when can we, you know, see the official statement that that is the new deadline?
I'll tell you what, I'll give it to you now. Do you want a big scoop?
Yes, please.
Everybody else, close your ears, okay? You ready?
I'm ready.
10 days from today.
10 days from today. Well, we're now 2 days from that deadline, and President Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff has held a three-hour meeting with Vladimir Putin in Moscow today. The Kremlin says talks were useful and constructive. We haven't heard from the White House yet, but Donald Trump is due to speak to President Zelensky of Ukraine today. The Kremlin may have proposed an air truce as a concession, but sources say Putin is unlikely to abandon his goal of fully occupying the regions of Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia and Kherson. How long would all of that take then? Are we about to see a new deadline imposed? Let's speak to Matthew Saville, Director of Military Sciences at the Royal United Services Institute. Matthew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So we await real concrete information as to what may be the result of these three-hour talks. What we do know is we're just a couple of days before this latest deadline set by President Trump for Russia to agree to ceasefire terms. Has that got any bearing on Putin's decision-making?
It's difficult to know, and I think you'd be a bold person who would suggest that you're going to get a concrete outcome. And I'm afraid for your listeners,